All right, you guys. Welcome to the show. Happy Monday morning to you. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, we're going to talk with Adam Morrow, the one guy I know in Cairo. I guess Nancy Yosef from McClatchy Newspapers reports from there pretty often, but Adam lives there. Reporter for Interpress Service. Also, I got Jeffrey Myron from the Cato Institute is coming on the show to talk about legalizing all drugs. Now, if you're anything like me, this is kind of old hat stuff. I mean, this is, you know, thinking things other than what TV says you're supposed to think 101 here. The war on drugs is, it's one of the worst things affecting the society. And in more ways than anybody can count, really. And everybody knows it. And even William F. Buckley said that it was a fool's errand and counterproductive 20 years ago. The only people who support anymore are the cops. And anyway, so Jeffrey Myron, though, he is a libertarian, I think. Cato Institute, capitalist economist from Harvard. And so he's going to make the utilitarian economist's case that even your grandpa will have to accept. Actually, he makes a really good bunch of points there. The way things have been are wrong. And it's way past time. Way past time. So, you know, that seems like a probably pretty good, you know, I don't know. There's a possibility of some real progress if we can get people to listen to guys like this, right? You want to attack the right from the right and the left from the left and that kind of thing. Does no good to bring on some patchouli stinking hippie arguing why he likes smoking weed, even though that's perfectly valid. Hippies can smoke weed if they want. What's it to you? But anyway, that's not what really makes, wins the argument. What wins the argument is a guy who says, oh no, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm a 10 capitalist. Ain't no patchouli stinking hippie at all. I'm an economist. And I say, legalize heroin. That's how you make progress. And especially, yeah, let's talk only about cocaine and heroin and the more destructive drugs the whole time because everybody wants to legalize acid, right? Acid is wonderful. Mushrooms, weed, all that is consensus. But people say, oh, I don't know, man, cocaine and heroin. And I can tell you the truth, I've known some people with some cocaine problems in my life. I've known a couple of people with some heroin problems in my life, too. Some of them are still alive, some of them not so much. So I take those drugs and addictions to them seriously. But boy, oh boy, shouldn't we be past equating concern with need for laws? At this point, haven't we seen the failure of that way of thinking all this time? Yeah, okay, anyway. Jeffrey Myron will be on the show to talk a little bit about that, and Adam Morrow on Egypt. Of course, in Egypt, just catch up a little bit, there was a revolution. In 2011, they overthrew America's sock puppet torture dictator, Hosni Mubarak. But then the conservative Muslim Brotherhood won the election for parliament and the presidency. And so after a year, the military overthrew and reinstated a dictatorship, held a fake election that had 1 or 3% turnout or some kind of nonsense as everyone expressed their disapproval with the process. It was like a Saddam Hussein level election. Low turnout, 98% victory, 98% of the vote for the leader. Like that election that Hillary Clinton held in Yemen when they replaced Saleh with his cousin or whatever. She called that a great day for democracy. There's only one guy on the ballot, you see. Same kind of thing in Egypt. So Adam Morrow, he's been on the show and he's talked about before how the current regime in Egypt, the climate of fear and et cetera. You know, the propaganda, the arrests and the torture and the clampdown and the everything about the police state is worse than under Mubarak. Now under the dictatorship of Field Marshal Sisi. Oh, you're supposed to say Sisi, but he's just a desk officer. Field Marshal. That means he's never been in the field. That means he's like Dick Cheney or one of these chicken hawks. Anyway, so I had a moral beyond to talk about the crisis there. Hey, you know, I'm really interested. I guess I should have asked him. Hey, think a lot about and have a lot to say about America's relationship with Sisi now. Just how's that working? All right. What time is it? Okay, good. I got a couple things more I can fit in here before the first break. On the Sunday show yesterday on KPFK, I interviewed Jonathan S. Lande. Of course, it was actually recorded Saturday for the show on Sunday. Lande for McClatchy Newspapers, and he and Hannah Alam had written this piece on, they had written this piece on how Obama's strategy in Iraq is going to take some time. It means years of escalation, I think that was the headline, the long war, and so we talked all about that, and yeah, it's just exactly as you feared. They're going back to war. And there are so many conflicting and competing interests at stake here. There's absolutely no way they can do anything but screw it up. And especially considering how their policy really makes no sense. By intervening at all with American air power and special forces on the ground, CIA on the ground, we turn the thing into an anti-American war, which just helps rally that many more people to the cause. And then I saw some expert idiot on CNN today saying, oh yeah, you know, we definitely have to outright ally with Iran now. Well, pardon, but we've been fighting the war in Iraq for Iran since 2003. And, at least, I guess you could say, Bush did the Sunni Arabs the courtesy of refusing to work with the Iranians on putting the Iranian stooges in power there in Baghdad the whole time. Mr. Expert on CNN this morning said we should outright ally with not just Iran, where the Shia live, but revolutionary Shiite Islam rules the state. The country is called the Islamic Republic of Iran. And by citing Michael Scheuer, who, you know Michael Scheuer, he's all about, yeah, let's bomb the hell out of our enemies and whoever happens to be near him. He told Fox News, no, don't back Assad. And you know Michael Scheuer, it's not because, you know, he puts Israel first and has an anti-Assad policy. He's been complaining about American policy of supporting the Mujahideen against Assad this whole time. But now he says, don't support Assad. Just because I don't want America to overthrow the guy in favor of these guys doesn't mean I want to support him against them, because that just puts America not just on the side of our own white Christian selves, even though, of course, it's mostly black and brown people in the American army. But anyway, white Christian civilization reinvading again, but also overtly on the side of the revolutionary Shiite Persians next door. And their Baathist allies in Syria, which is just, you know, can you expect people on the National Security Council to have a conversation about, like, yeah, but then what might happen if we do that, Dave? Seems like we might just make everything worse and rally that many more enemies to the cause of the people we're trying to fight. Well, that's why it's going to take a long time, Scott, because intervening is just going to make matters worse and worse and worse. Yeah, I know. Sorry. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Live in La Vida Baroca by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Later on, I'm going to complain about American policy towards Somalia. Insert Sideshow Bob grumbling there. And the cops. Oh, man, did you guys see Riley Balco in the Washington Post today? I mean, the thing's like 15,000 words long or something. You're going to have to put aside a little bit of time to read it. It's part of why I didn't put together a whole show today, because I was sitting there reading this Balco article. It's, well, I'll tell you now, it's called How Municipalities in St. Louis County, Missouri Profit from Poverty. And it's just absolutely maddening. It's really something else. Anyway, talk about more about, oh, Jesus, me and the talking today. We will talk more about the cops and the police state later in the show. But right now, I want to talk a little bit more about that Lande article and interview from my KPFK show. By the way, I was not aware of this, but I was sort of kind of aware that it was a possibility. This is sort of relevant, I promise. There's a website called AudioPort where people who have shows on the Pacifica Radio Network can upload their shows to it. So I've been doing that for quite some time now. I never really knew whether any of the other Pacifica stations were playing it. So I sent an email off to Alan Minsky, who is the program director of KPFK, which airs my show every Sunday morning. And I said, hey, is there a way for you to tell, or do you know, if any of these other stations have been playing my show? And he said, yeah, these 10 stations. Oh, no. He says, these two stations seem to be picking it up every week. WPRR and KOWA. Every week. And these 10 stations have picked it up on certain weeks over the past 8 months. Some more than others. That's WPFW, KNFS, KKRN, KPFP, KRFP, KKFI, WZRD, WEFT, No Lies Radio, and Independent Davis Media, which is cool because I'm already on in Davis on their college station there, K-Dirt. And so anyway, that's pretty good, right? That's my anti-war radio show. It's a half-hour show. I do Sunday mornings for KPFK in Los Angeles, and seems like it's getting picked up and played around lots of places, so that's really good to know. Thanks, Pacifica Stations, for playing my stuff. And then anyway, so yeah, yesterday's show was with Jonathan Lande from McClatchy Newspapers, and you guys are familiar. And so we're talking about the strategy. It's one Islamic state, but the strategy is broken in two because you have, you know, the nation formerly known as Iraq in the east and the state formerly known as Syria in the west. I guess there's still a rump of Syria left. There's still a rump of Iraq left, but it's more like Shiistan now, the land between Baghdad and Basra, including Baghdad and Basra. But anyway, so the policy in Syria, this is the part where my head just explodes still. You see, because politics, Obama can't side with Assad. And I'm not saying he should side with Assad. Just before the break, I was saying, no, he should not side with Assad. That will just make our problems worse. The policy should be one of non-intervention. Non-intervention. But what's Obama's policy? Obama's policy is to double, triple down on building up the Free Syrian Army. The pathetic joke of the so-called moderates who have never been more than a small percentage of the insurgency in Syria, the field of which has been dominated by the jihadists all this time since 2011. Who do you think you're kidding? And now they're going to build up the Free Syrian Army, this third force, from the ether. From the void, I guess they'll call Mandrake the Magician to come and create this third force army like he does Federal Reserve money. And then this Third Force Army is going to kill, count them off with me now, the Islamic State, the Al-Nusra Front, the Islamic Front, Arar al-Sham, and whatever, and Assad, and the Russian and Iranian and Hezbollah-backed state army of Syria. All at the same damn time. And I says to Landay, I says, okay, look, let's just fast forward the question 1 second here. If you're telling me the policy is not back Assad and let the government of Syria reclaim its army's monopoly on that land, then what you're telling me is the policy is, because again, it's not non-intervention, that's for sure. You're telling me the policy is to break Syria into pieces. The U.S. policy is to somehow create a new government that will exclude the Islamic Front, al-Nusra, and ISIS, but will still be run by Sunni Arabs outside of the rule of Damascus. And he said, no, because the deal is they want to take on the Islamic State and then they'll worry about Assad and, you know, maybe reintegrating the country. Again, I'm not saying that America should back Assad, but I am saying, and I have been saying for 3 years straight on this show, that if the United States was not intervening in Syria, Assad would have already won. He would have won back in 2011 if America had not been working with Saudi, Qatar, Turkey, Jordan to coordinate all the weapons and guns for these rebels and the politics, continuing to create these bogus Syrian councils of expats, in Doha to supposedly be the new umbrella government organization. Ridiculousness. And you know what? I am going to play my Hillary clip here because it's not gratuitous. This is important. When she says, are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? This is before ISIS broke off from Nusra. This is when ISIS was just ISIS. I mean, when Nusra was just Nusra. Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria, basically. And so Hillary is being questioned. This is from March or maybe February. I think early March 2010. She's being questioned by CBS News, and she's saying, they're asking her, why aren't we doing more to help the rebels overthrow Assad? Because that was the Israeli-driven narrative of the political problem then. And so Hillary's excuse is that Al-Qaeda supports the insurgency. So by supporting the insurgency, are we supporting Al-Qaeda? Right? Now, you could say that's a slippery slope argument, but yeah, a 1 foot of a slip. And yeah, it's Hillary using it as the excuse, but she's the one who at that exact moment and throughout the rest of her term for that year was doing everything she could to encourage exactly that policy of backing these guys even more. But even as she terms it, supporting the rebellion at all is in essence supporting Al-Qaeda's position there.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria?
Not so much Hamas. Al-Qaeda? Yeah. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. You know, Chuck Woolery on Twitter is it's a thing in the world, man. You follow Chuck Woolery? Hell yeah. I'm about to tweet him right now. I like messing with him a little bit, but only kind of in friendly ways, you know. Government is horrible. Government is incompetent. Government is theft. I want them to take over the world for me. Really? So here he calls the Democratic Party communist. So I just said, oh, come on, the Democratic Party is clearly a corporatist, imperialist, fascist organization. like the Republicans. Communist. Come on. I mean, they're totalitarians. And yeah, they do sometimes pretend to care about poor people, but they don't, you know. I guess real communists don't either. I don't know how you differentiate. But no, they're fascists. Yet the grassroots are communists. That's fair. JDA in the chat room. You know, I don't know. I actually prefer communists to liberals. At least communists hate cops and hate empire and wars. To me, well, and it depends on how you define it. To me, a liberal is basically a rank-and-file Democrat voter. A lefty who's compromised with private property. And I'm for private property, but it just goes to show how, you know, kind of untrue to their own principles they are, if you know what I mean. But anyway, if you find actual leftists and progressive types who don't identify with the Democratic Party but put their principles first, then you tend to find people who are really good on, well, not perfect, but tend to be good on, you know, civil liberties questions and that kind of thing. The rights of even losers to have a fair defense at trial, that kind of stuff, you know? And oppose wars, which are, of course, the worst violation of everybody's rights all around, so. Anyway, that's why I talk to so many progressives and lefties and some liberals on this show. Because it's all about priorities. It's all about the subject matter, not who's who, if you know what I mean. All right, back to Iraq here. So in 2007, you heard the slogan, "The surge is working, the surge is working." And then later they updated it to, "The surge worked, the surge worked." And what they were really taking credit for was the fall in violence that had come with the end of the civil war, where the Shiite militias, along with the American Army and Marine Corps, ethnically, sectarianly, I guess, cleansed Baghdad of Sunni Arabs and made it an 85% Shiite city. And then the Sunni Arabs basically called ceasefire. They had too many enemies. They're fighting the Iranians, the militias, the Iraqi army, the Americans, and their local al-Qaeda jihadist nut jobs who had gotten way out of control. And so, really, at that point, Petraeus finally accepted the Sunni tribal leaders' long-standing offer that had originally been made in 03 and had been made over and over again throughout the whole occupation. If you'll just pay us and give us some guns and allow us to patrol our own neighborhoods, then we'll stop attacking the occupation. And so Petraeus finally took him up on that. And so the worst part of the sectarian civil war was over, and Petraeus basically really won his victory against George W. Bush and said, no, we're not going to have victory over the Sunni-based insurgency. We're going to bribe them to stop shooting our guys. And Bush said, oh, okay, well, what the hell do I know about things? Whatever you say, David. And so that was the way it happened. But here's the thing of it. As maybe you can tell by what I just said, that's just surface stuff, right? That doesn't mean that they solved any of the problems. And if you remember the propaganda of 2007 and the surge into Iraq, it was to solve the political problems that were still left outstanding, huge ones, to achieve the benchmarks. And if you were really paying attention, then you know that they, first of all, delayed Petraeus' testimony before the Senate by, I think, 2 months, at least 1 month. And then finally, when he testified, yeah, he didn't really so much mention the benchmarks. He said, well, you know, the rates of people, men's bodies being found in the morning with power drill holes in their skulls has decreased somewhat. So pat me on the back, everybody. When, of course, it was the surge that, you know, aided and abetted the very worst of all of that. But anyway, so the benchmarks were supposed to be that the Sunnis would be integrated into the police, into the army, and into the government. And by sharing in the spoils, if not, you know, being the leaders of the state anymore, but by sharing in the spoils enough, they would hold the country together. But the problem is, America put Shiites in power, specific ones from the Dawa Party and the Supreme Islamic Council, who had always made it perfectly plain, since 2003 on, had made it plain that they had no interest in even really trying to rule over the Sunni Arabs or the majority Sunni Arab parts of Iraq. They just wanted to use America to take Baghdad for them. And then they were what they called themselves strong federalists, meaning they don't really care what the hell happens to the Sunnis. They got the worst part of Iraq. Let them, you know, stew in it. And now they don't control the central government anymore. They can't divert all the oil revenue to themselves. Get bent was basically the message of Dawa and Skiri, the groups that America put in power because they needed us. The actual grassroots Shiite leaders like Muqtada al-Sadr, he didn't need us or Iran. He wanted to make a deal based on Iraqi nationalism and have a coalition government with the Sunni Arabs and against Iran's designs for breaking off southern Shiistan and against American designs for staying forever. So America sided with it with the Iran-backed guys, betting that it was going to work out for them in the end. Well, it didn't. So all this is America's big stinking mess in the first place. And then in 07, after they had accomplished what the Iranian parties wanted them to do, kick the Sunnis out of Baghdad, give them no reason any longer to need to compromise with them at all, they quit compromising with them. And now here we are 7 years later. That was in 2007. Here we are 7 years later. 7 years of the Shiite government telling all the predominantly Sunni Arab and parts of Iraq and the Sunni tribal structure and the citizens of Mosul and Fallujah and Ramadi and these other predominantly Sunni cities, go screw yourselves. Now they got rid of Maliki and they're bringing in this guy Abadi, and they're saying that now they're going to accomplish the goals of the surge without the troops. There won't be American GIs to help the Sunni tribal leaders hunt down and kill ISIS, only with drones and F-18s from the air. And then not only are they going to defeat the Sunni, the jihadist part of the insurgency that's 1,000 times stronger than it ever was back then, they're going to do so from the air, and with the help of the Kurdish Peshmerga and the Shiite militias and the Iranian-backed, the Quds Force and the Revolutionary Guards Force and the Al-Haq Brigade and all that that's going to come and help them do this. And that then, in the midst of all of that, this guy Abadi is now going to bring all the Sunnis into power sharing and money sharing far beyond anything that's happened in the last 13 years and 12 years. And that this is going to solve the problem. And then that's going to cause the Sunni tribes to rise up and overthrow ISIS. Sorry, it's not going to happen. I've been telling you this whole time, too. What a bankrupt, ridiculous strategy. It was a failure with, St. Petraeus, His Holiness, on the ground there with all of his magical powers and all of the powers of all the propaganda telling you how well it was working. It never worked then. It can't work now. It's over. Iraq is over. America broke it. And, you know, when you hear people saying that that ISIS works for the U.S., it's not really true. But ISIS is all America's fault, from Iraq War II to supporting the rebellion in general in Syria and supporting all our satellite states and their financing of all these different jihadist groups in Syria the last 3 years. Got that much right. It's still treason, even if they're not outright sock puppets. Hey, all, Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day, is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West, while he learns new things about the world and himself. Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal as we knew it is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Hey, if you saw antiwar.com over the weekend, you might have noticed that the top story was Israel used 2009 video to justify hospital attack by the heroic Gareth Porter. Oh, it's still in the top headlines there at antiwar.com right now, right in the middle of the top headlines there. Oh, yeah, no, we had to bomb that hospital because Islam's was shooting rockets at us from in there. And here, look, here's some video to prove it. The Israelis lied. Yeah, but you can't lie to Gareth Porter, man. You can try to lie to Gareth Porter, but it ain't never going to work. Not never. And so Gareth Porter writes up how, no, that video is from 2009. You're liars and murderers. And he's got another piece coming out. That's why he's not on the show today. He's got a follow-up piece coming out about the broader context of Israel killing people. And then claiming, oh, man, they shot a rocket at us from somewhere near there or whatever as their excuse for killing people. And anyway, so looking forward to that. That'll be a whole interview there. You know, I don't know, man. Think about that. What other government? I mean, the U.S. government lies about everything all the time. I guess maybe the Ukrainian government are liars on the order of Israel. I don't know of anybody else who would be that blatant about it. Hey, look, here's some footage from 2009 that here in a minute you're going to be able to prove is from 2009. But whatever, anyway, yeah, that's why we killed that hospital full of people. Was because of the, yeah, what happened in this completely irrelevant video clip. Anyway, so Gareth will be on later in the week, I don't know, by the end of the week, to talk about both pieces there. But you can find the original, the first piece, it's a truth out. It'll be a two-parter for truth out. Israel used 2009 video to justify hospital attack. That's right up there with the Ukrainians said they killed 2,000 Russians. They killed them so good that there's just nothing left of them, including any evidence of their existence at all. Wow, you guys are a great shot, man. That's amazing. you know, I was talking with Eric Garris, who he's been at this nonstop since 1995 at antiwar.com, but yeah, he's been at this for a lot longer than that, generally speaking. He said he's never heard, Eric Margolis said the same thing, they've never heard of a government that lied as much as the government of Ukraine. They make Benjamin Netanyahu look like the epitome of honesty. Everything that they say, hey, you know what we did? They sound like little kids. Hey, guess what? We blew up a whole convoy of Russian artillery overnight with our artillery. Yeah, they had tanks and they had all these artillery pieces, and we totally blowed them up, dude. And then daybreak comes, and someone says, oh yeah? Well, where? And then they said, you're a liar. We never said that. And then they move on to their next one. It's really incredible. I mean, they claim that Russia invaded over and over again. On CNN today, I could even see the guy's brow furrow a little bit where he says, some say, including actual Russians there too. And you could see he was a little bit confused because he could swear Winston Smith up here reading the news to me. Didn't I claim, he was saying to himself, that Russia invaded Ukraine 2 weeks ago? Now we're back to some say there may have been some Russians over the line? Huh. Being a CNN reporter must be fun. I wonder what they say to each other at lunch. Man, we are such liars. Isn't it fun pretending like the February coup never happened? That the entirety of the story of Ukraine is how Russia started it? All right. See you tomorrow, Bob. I mean, I guess when you're getting paid that kind of money, you get to go and drink drinks with all the fancy people at all the fancy drinking places. You know, parties and stuff. That can be a hell of an influence, apparently, on a bunch of news anchors who've never actually done any journalism themselves. All right. And anyway, actually, as long as I'm mentioning Ukraine real quick here, let me mention that they had a report that was, yeah, I don't know. I think it was more or less accurate because it sounded more or less accurate. And that was that there are militias still killing people, possibly on both sides. Although, you know, they portrayed this person getting shot in a situation where, as CNN explained it this morning in this clip that I watched, it would have had to have been the Azov Battalion, pro-government Nazis, who proudly fly the Volksangel of the SS. And it would have had to have been them. It's on territory that they hold in Mariupol. There was some car, I guess, was speeding. It was full of civilians, and they lit it up with machine gun fire. And she's covering this, and yet the reporter, and yet trying to imply like it's some kind of mystery of who shot up the car with machine guns at close range, way on the Ukrainian government side of the lines there. There are no rebels with machine guns anywhere near there. I mean, I guess if they wanted to try to pretend it was an artillery shell hit the car, that would have been one thing. But just goes to show how, listen, the narrative must be anything but the guys fighting on the side of the Ukraine government just waxed this family, killed one lady, and, you know, wounded the rest of them. They didn't really point to any evidence that the Donbass Battalion or whoever were still fighting, although I don't rule that out. I'm not saying it's impossible. I guess they pointed to some artillery shells on the ground, but I don't know exactly where they were or what the hell. They claimed that they were running from incoming fire. But, you know, that's part of the deal, I'm sure, of having a rebellion of this nature in eastern Ukraine, is that the, you know, self-appointed leadership, they can make a deal with Kiev, but that doesn't necessarily mean that all the different militias fighting are going to respect it. And just as well, the Nazi stormtroopers that the Kiev government, that, let's be honest about it, that the USA, Washington, D.C. government in Kiev has sent to fight this war in the east, the Right Sector Militia and the Azov Battalion and whatever other pro-Nazi auxiliaries of theirs, they can't be controlled by D.C. or Kiev either. That's what they're doing there, fighting. You read all about them in the Telegraph. And they say, yeah, all they want is a clean country. You know, cleansed of those who don't belong. The Untermenschen, so to speak. The subhumans, as Yatsenyuk put it. And he's Jewish, by the way. They say he's Jewish. I don't know. The prime minister, the American-appointed prime minister of Ukraine, has referred to the people in the east as subhuman. Man, you don't want to start writing up lists of subhumans, man, with a bunch of Svoboda and Right Sector Nazis running around, do you, Yats? What the hell Twilight Zone world is this, man? And anyway, you know, I need to get over it. I need to call Robert Perry, and it'd be nice, I guess, if he apologized for saying libertarians are all a bunch of would-be totalitarians. But I should apologize to him for the terrible things I said to him after he wrote that stupid article, because, god dang it, I really miss Bob Perry's reporting on this show, his journalism on this Ukraine issue. He's written, I don't know, 2 or 3 dozen just 5-star awesome articles for Consortium News since last November, really, especially since the coup in February, where, you know, I just can't think of a thing he screwed up yet, man. Bob Perry is just batting 1,000 over there at consortiumnews.com. This one is about America's media's coverage of the Nazis fighting in the east for the Ukraine coup d'etat USA junta in Kiev, and how they just keep calling them nationalists and keep pretending that these guys don't claim that, yeah, they love Hitler. They're happy to tell you what a great guy Hitler is, and that was why their fathers and grandfathers were happy to fight for Hitler in World War II. Now, by the way, fighting against communists is fine. Fighting for Nazis is something else. And the Banderist group that fought for the Nazis in World War II, that these guys trace their proud lineage to, participated in the Holocaust, massacred Jews and Poles in the Holocaust. They weren't just some anti-communist army brigade or something. They were war criminals. just like these guys. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Jeff Myron from the Cato Institute and Harvard University. Welcome to the show, Jeff. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. You're the author of this book, Drug War Crimes, The Consequences of Prohibition. I see it here. At independent.org, the Independent Institute. David Thoreau and Anthony Gregory and our friends over there, Bob Higgs. And here's your page at Cato, Director of Economic Studies there. Good deal. So the case that you are famous for making is one of my favorites, and it's something that, honestly, I just take it for granted so much that I hardly even give it any coverage on this show. And that is legalizing not just weed, but legalizing all drugs in America. And it's especially nice to have the case made by a Harvard economist and a Cato scholar as opposed to some drug addict who just likes doing drugs, even though that should be good enough, in my opinion. Drug addicts can do drugs if they want. But anyway, so go ahead and give us the kind of nutshell case for legalizing drugs, and I'll try to do my best with follow-ups and stuff, if that's all right.
Sure. The nutshell case is that while some people misuse drugs and the use of drugs is sometimes harmful for the users or for other people, the attempt to suppress drug use, and particularly to try to suppress, you know, irresponsible drug use by outlawing drugs, seems to generate far more negative consequences than beneficial consequences. Driving the market underground leads to more crime and corruption, to quality control problems, significant expenditure, to foregone tax revenue, and other issues. So this is a case where the treatment is clearly worse than the disease, even while accepting that, of course, drug use is sometimes ill-advised.
There you go. Well, so I guess, you know, I hate to get all Moses-like on you, but what about the children? Because that's always the out, is that, you know what, there's a lot of things that, yes, you're right, ought to be up to adults to decide. But if you legalize, especially, of course, the boogeymen, heroin and cocaine, you are telling children that it's okay. And God dang it, it's not. And damn any other consequences. We can't let you tell the children that, Jeffrey.
So I think that we let parents and other adults try to tell children what is good for them and what's not for good for them in a ton of cases that are very important without actually going to the extreme of prohibition. Very simple example is alcohol. Alcohol is legal for adults, and we still try to control access for children, but the main reason that kids don't do it, to the extent they don't, is that the parents are involved. There's other things that we don't make illegal at all. We don't make it illegal to not do your homework. It's pretty important to do your homework and things like that, but we let parents make those decisions. Most importantly, a lot of kids have ready access to drugs under prohibition. We're not preventing kids from having access by making it illegal. You just have to walk by most high schools, you know, in the middle of the day, and you'll see there's some kids outside, you know, looking a little slightly shady because they're selling drugs. So the policy is just not doing what it's trying to do.
Yeah. You know, I was having a conversation earlier on a different topic where this just kind of came up as an example, but I think it's important for this case. I actually remember where I was when I was 14 and with my 14-year-old friends, and we all decided that we liked smoking weed. It made us real high, and we didn't see what the big deal was. We didn't have to puke or feel hungover, feel terrible, like when we got drunk from wine we stole from 7-Eleven. And so apparently my friends concluded, and I remember everyone sitting around in the circle where we were skateboarding, and all of them, you know, the gears turning in their heads as they all agreed and concluded, came to consensus that everything they told us about all drugs apparently is a lie. So let's get a hold of any and all drugs that we can possibly get a hold of now, because apparently it's all no big deal just because they lied to us about weed. And I knew a little bit better than that and thought, well, you know, I think they might have a case, because I think I learned why some of these drugs actually could be harmful in other ways and where. But for them, that was all they needed to know, was that they've been so propagandized against the devil weed that as soon as they realized what a big deal it wasn't, they just assumed that was the case for all the rest of the drugs. That's how 14-year-olds think, you know?
I agree with that, and I think that's one of the crucial reasons that outlawing drugs, as opposed to milder measures that might be adopted to try to discourage use of drugs, such as tax rates or education information, are misguided, is because when you outlaw something, you're saying it's just verboten. It has no legitimate use. You should never do it. That it's a really, really horrible thing. But kids figure out that while sometimes people clearly have bad outcomes from using drugs, that it's not this horrific boogeyman that it's made out to be. And then they stop listening to lots of things that adults tell them. They figure adults are just, you know, BSing them a lot of the time. And so that means we don't have the ability to make nuanced and sort of thoughtful, constructive suggestions to kids, like, you shouldn't probably be as a 16 or 17-year-old doing lots of drugs and alcohol, but for sure you shouldn't be driving under the influence. And if we gave the sort of more nuanced message, I think more kids would say, you know, I'm not necessarily going to listen to you about whether I consume alcohol, but I will try not to drive under the influence of alcohol, and that would be a huge benefit.
Right. Well, and, you know, you really bring up a point there, maybe I accidentally did, kind of, about prohibition of alcohol, where all of my early experiences with alcohol, maybe this is for the good actually, were with hard, you know, either liquor or wine. It made me terribly sick, so I never did become a drinker. But none of us kids, we could have gotten a lot worse trouble for it and stealing and all kinds of things, because we didn't have access to just Budweiser, right? We didn't get to learn how to drink on Budweiser. We learned how to drink from somebody swiped a bottle of Jack from their old man or something, because that was all we could get. So same kind of, you know, perverse incentives get built into the situation, you know?
And there's a lot of examples from other societies that do use alcohol more generally for, say, teenagers who are 14, 15, 16, where it is a more common social activity for younger kids, you know, younger people in their teens to consume moderate amounts of alcohol. And it takes some of the forbidden fruit out of it. It takes some of the mystique out of it. And those places have no worse outcomes, in some cases better outcomes, for things like traffic fatalities than the United States. Yeah.
And yes, I was kind of a punk kid. Not anymore, though. I'm all grown up now. In every way. Now here's the thing that really needs focusing on, and we've still got a couple of minutes before the first break here, Jeffrey. But so can you talk a little bit about maybe what it would look like to have heroin and cocaine for sale legally, and the change, how different that would be from the way it is now for the neighborhood, you know, for the people who are the bystanders of the drug war?
I mean, I think the crucial thing is that the violence that occurs in many neighborhoods because of the underground nature of the drug market would be much smaller, would sort of essentially disappear. Okay? It means that people who went to purchase these substances, okay, would be able to know what dosages they were getting, and that what they were purchasing was actually heroin or cocaine or whatever, rather than some adulterants, or rather than being a purity that was very different than what the seller had indicated. So certain negative effects of drugs, such as overdoses, accidental poisonings, would be less frequent because people would understand what they were getting. We rarely see those sorts of events, the negative events from use, happen with legal substances because the market makes sure the quality control is reasonable. An extreme case is that because prohibition elevates prices for opiates in particular and makes it more advantageous to want to inject because you get a big bang for your buck, which is important if it's really expensive, people inject and they share dirty needles, and that contributes to the spread of HIV, other bloodborne infections. Okay? That should be much less, okay, or much less common in a legal market. We might see heroin packaged with disposable, inexpensive syringes for those people who wanted to inject, but a lot more people would simply not inject if it was legal and therefore substantially cheaper. Now, in terms of exactly where it's sold and all that, Libertarians don't really want to take a stand on that. Their answer is the markets would decide. So probably it would be sold in pharmacies, but much more like an over-the-counter medication than as a prescription drug. But there might be multiple ways in which it's available. The main crucial things is the negative effects of the black market would be gone.
Right. Well, and I want to talk more about that on the other side of this break, what effect the war on drugs has had for especially poorer neighborhoods across America these last decades, really. The game, that's what they call it, right? We'll be right back. It's Jeff Myron from Cato.org. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Now, I meant to say there, and I kind of screwed it up. Some of those kids that I knew back when who made that bad conclusion about all the drug war propaganda they'd ever heard actually ended up having pretty severe drug problems and screwed up lives after that. Now that I think about it. Or actually, I thought about that before. I meant to say it, but forgot to. Anyway, so yeah, real consequences to that kind of stuff. I'm talking with Jeff Myron from Cato and Harvard, and we're talking about the economics of the war on drugs and all the different ways that it has screwed up our society and why we need to legalize, yes, even the hardest, scariest drugs. You know, I had a science teacher, Jeff, in high school who would go out secretly at night and give clean needles to the drug addicts downtown at great, you know, legal and personal risk to himself, because that was a crime in Austin, Texas, to go give needles to aid and abet heroin abuse. And he was going down there and saying, listen, I'm a scientist. Let me teach you about HIV. Please use these clean needles, you know? But no, he was a felon. I don't know. I guess he got away with it, but it was a big deal. He like told us like in whispers that this is what he was doing. A big crime in Austin, at least then. So a little bit of just how screwed up the mindset gets to try to make these magical wishes about the effects of prohibition come true. You know, we just have to, we can't ever admit we're wrong. We just have to keep doubling down on bad policies. Like it's a crime to give away a clean needle to somebody, you know, it's crazy. So also I wanted to ask you about, you know, generations of crime. And I guess, you know, everybody's seen The Wire, but everybody's seen Cops too. And, you know, we have a giant welfare state and giant underclasses in most of the major cities in America of people who have no real opportunity, even for education, to have any real opportunity in the market. And so, and they're completely outlawed, really. For being on 10 kinds of probation from Sunday for every little thing, because they don't have any good legal representation and that kind of thing. They're low-hanging fruit for the state for other reasons. So they really have no other business to be in other than drug black markets. And it ends up becoming a vicious and bloody, and depending on where you are, but it can be a brutal trade for people to be involved in, right in the middle of town where but people have no other alternative. And we kind of made it this way over decades. What do you think of that?
Well, there are certainly many reasons why people in some towns, neighborhoods, et cetera, face a lot of difficulties. It's not just drug policy. It's also education policy and housing policy that are not well designed. But the drug wars certainly play a big role. The violence, of course, you know, directly harms large numbers of young people, mainly especially African-American and Hispanic, but it also creates the wrong incentives for people to try to get rich in the drug trade as opposed to staying in school. It makes those neighborhoods less pleasant, which harms housing values. So it's a significant contributor to the dysfunction in inner cities in particular, amongst the sort of least advantaged population in particular.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to the 2 million people in prison, the 7 million people in some kind of jail or on parole or probation, if you include them as well, do you know what, you know, roughly what percentage of that is strictly drug war and drug war collateral damage compared to, I don't know, I guess just husbands beating their wives or whatever?
Well, it's hard to know exactly how much of the collateral damage. The direct amount, if you look at federal prisoners, is quite substantial. Something in excess of a half of federal prisoners are there on drug charges. For state and local prisoners, which is a much, much bigger amount than federal prisoners, it's maybe 20 to 22-23% in recent years. So it's not, if you only look at the direct cases, a huge fraction. It's a large fraction. But then there's a lot of indirect effects. Some of the theft, people arrested for theft, for robberies, were doing that to support drug habits in part. Some of the people arrested for violence was violence that was generated by the drug trade. Some people who are in jail have been sent back for failing a urine test after they got out and were on parole, probation, whatever their initial crime may have been. So I wouldn't be surprised if a fairly substantial fraction you would attribute to indirectly to the drug trade over and above the part that's the direct effect of locking people up on drug charges.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had a friend that I knew when I was real young. I didn't know him for a long time. I talked to him again. He was a cop in Washington, D.C. I only got to talk to him briefly, but he said basically his job consisted of chasing crackheads around all night. And I told him, well, you know, it's your fault. You know, they'd be sitting at home doing cocaine. And the only reason they're running and doing crack is because you're chasing them, you know, kind of
right.
thing. And he had no idea what I was talking about. He couldn't possibly fathom how that could be the case at all. But it occurred to me that, as well as his mind, that really the entire theory of American policing has been completely destroyed by the war on drugs, where anyone who is an outlaw drug user is assumed by the cops to be basically subhuman, the lowest scum of the earth. They might as well be rapists and murderers and organized crime rings, even if really they're just harmless drug addicts at worst, drug abusers at worst, maybe just users. And it's basically turned the mentality of the police against the entire population of the American people. It's us and them. And if it wasn't for them, they think we would all just tear each other apart. Because of what animals we all are, because they've been, you know, from their so distraught point of view of the world, that's the way it seems to them. You know, if he wasn't chasing crackheads around D.C. all night, they'd overrun the place.
Yeah, that is an assumption many people make. Of course, it's completely belied by experience from when we didn't have drug prohibition laws, from experience with alcohol, from experiences with countries that have much, much laxer drug laws than we do, bordering on legalization, such as the Netherlands or Portugal. But it's a common assertion, unfortunately not based on the evidence.
Yeah. Well, now, so maybe part of the problem is that this requires thinking about too much, and that really an opinion in America is a thing that you think the government ought to do to people. So if you don't like drugs, you think drugs should be illegal. It's just as simple as that. There's no economic questions that need to be brought into discussion. That's just how it is, right?
Well, I think that there is a tendency for many people to have a view about what is the right way to run your life, and to think other people shouldn't run their lives the same way. And I think that cuts across party lines to a huge degree. The people who think of themselves as liberal, some people who think of themselves as liberal, some as conservative, have particular views and tend to want to impose those views on others rather than just saying, I have the way I would like to do things, but I'm going to let other people do things differently. It's basically none of my business.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I guess it does seem, though, on this subject, particularly because pot has been legalized in Washington, Colorado now, that at least people are paying attention to whether, you know, a nightmare breaks out or not. And it seems like the conversation is getting more mainstream about whether, you know, something more reasonable can be done about this. So, you know, and I think it's important for, like, dialectical type purposes that you are staking out the position. Yes, heroin and cocaine, too, because, you know, if we're mealy-mouthed about that, then basically we're ceding, you know, our economic argument about why we're right, you know, that none of this works on any of these drugs. And so,
well, I think it's important to talk about those as well as marijuana, partially because many of the people who are advocating for legalizing marijuana have a certain self-interest. They would like to be able to consume marijuana and be left alone by the law, and that's great, but that's not the only reason. We shouldn't just legalize things that lots of people want to do. We should legalize everything, unless it's really harming innocent third parties, such as driving drunk or something like that. And so people who are heroin users are a very, very small fraction of the population, but their rights, they're to do what they want to do as long as they're not harming someone else, are just as important as those of people who like to drink red wine on Saturday nights or people who like to smoke marijuana. So it's important from that perspective. But also, a lot of the expenditure that governments are making, a lot of the violence that's still occurring in drug markets from government driving it underground, is not occurring in the marijuana market anymore, partially because the marijuana market has become much closer to being legal. And so if we're going to reduce the violence and reduce the overdoses and reduce the spread of HIV and all those things, we have to be talking about legalizing those other drugs in addition to marijuana.
Right. Yeah, I about laughed out loud when I read a Mexican pot farmer saying, well, I guess I'm just going to have to grow alfalfa or whatever it was, because I forgot what it was, but it was something, you know, a basic staple, because there's just no money in the pot market anymore.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about competition. Competition isn't good for the competitors. It's good for the consumers, because the consumers get lower prices. So, yeah, marijuana is just another commodity like everything else. Yep. Some people are not going to be quite so interested in growing it.
Right, and that much money stolen right out of the pocket of the local drug distribution warlord in Mexico, too. So, nice benefits all
around. Exactly.
All right, thank you so much for your time. It's great to make your acquaintance, have you on the show, Jeff.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, everybody. That is Jeffrey Myron. He is the Director of Economic Studies at Cato. Find him at cato.org. And he teaches at Harvard. And you can find his book, Drug War Crimes, The Consequences of Prohibition, at independent.org. We'll be right back in a sec with Ray McGovern. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Well, I got a special surprise guest I'm working on getting for the last half hour. Might want to stay tuned to that. We'll see what happens. I don't know. I also got a special surprise guest right now. It's our friend Ray McGovern, who I didn't know was going to be on the show today until just now. Hey, Ray, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you joining us from far away. Where?
I'm in Moscow.
You're in Moscow. What are you doing in Moscow?
I was speaking this morning at something called the U.S.-Russia Forum, which is run a couple times a year, once in Moscow, once usually in New York or Washington. It's a group of people who are mostly academics, business people, an intelligence person every now and then, talking about what's happened to relations between our two countries and how we might contribute to restore them or improve them or prevent them from getting out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Great. So tell us the news. Who was there? Who spoke? What progress was made? What's the big deal? Sounds interesting.
Well, it really was, yeah. I very seldom get personal contact with these folks and have only been in Moscow twice before in my life. So this was a really good chance to rub shoulders with very interesting people. I learned from the editor-in-chief from Komsomolskaya Pravda, which is their mass circulation newspaper, the biggest one, that they printed the entire text of veteran intelligence professionals for sanity memo to Angela Merkel last week, where we warned her, look, Mrs. Merkel, all that fuzzy photography that is supposed to prove that the Russians have invaded Ukraine, well, kick the tires. We didn't say kick the tires. We said German idiom for, you know, hey, take a close look at that, because that that kind of evidence reminds me, or reminds us, of the evidence that used to justify an attack on Iraq just 12 years ago. Not mistaken intelligence, but rather fraudulent intelligence. So that that memo, which was only three pages, eight of us signed on to that. That made it big time. It was also in the Süddeutsche Zeitung in Germany, which, well, until recently was the best daily newspaper in Europe. So we got some good play. We're even pretty sure that Angela Merkel herself received a copy of it before she went off to Wales
for
the NATO summit. So that's unusual. A playback for that.
You know, I always wonder about that. You title these things as open letter memos, basically, from kind of a shadow, you know, group of CIA analysts, in a sense. And I always wonder about, you know, the efficacy of that. And I actually kind of thought that, yeah, I'd give it like a 51% chance that that helps it come to the attention of, you know, I don't know if Obama reads them, Ray, but I wouldn't have doubted that someone would have pointed out to Angela Merkel that, hey, listen, these retired CIA guys have written you a thing. You might want to look at it.
Yeah. Yeah, the Süddeutsche exposure, and Süddeutsche was only about seven of the German newspapers that carried a report on it, makes it pretty much a certain thing that it would have been brought to her attention. And I think it's really important because, you know, what I've been saying, particularly in the interviews that I've given German TV channels, is that it's high time that Germany grew up, you know? World War II was a long time ago, and Germany still dances to Washington's tune. Angela Merkel doesn't need to do that anymore. Matter of fact, Germany's interests here with the sanctions and natural gas that they need from Russia, her interests or German interests are not identical to those of Washington, whatever Washington's are. And so we thought we'd just brace her with this, say, now grow up. And besides Mrs. Merkel, 12 years ago, when there were all kinds of reports and foggy or hazy photography, such as has been used to show that the Russians have invaded Ukraine, 12 years ago, that kind of stuff was used to argue for war on Iraq, a war that by any definition, or at least by Nuremberg's definition, was a war of aggression. Now, her predecessor, Gerhard Schröder, stepped up to the plate on that. He said, you know, we know what a war of aggression is. And, you know, if you're looking for a coalition of the willing, you got an unwilling coalition here as far as Germany is concerned. France did the same thing. Do you remember how Donald Rumsfeld railed out against them as the old Europe? And, you know, there was a congressman that didn't want French fries to be sold at the congressional cafeteria anymore. They had to be freedom fries. It really reached ridiculous proportions. But of course, the French and the Germans were right on. They were exactly right. And, you know, when you think about the seriousness of this, Scott, you know, the Nuremberg after World War II, and you know, I was around for that. I mean, I was real little, but at least I remember in the aftermath when the Nuremberg Tribunal came in, they defined a war of aggression as the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes only insofar as it contains the accumulated evil of the whole. Now, you think torture, think kidnapping, think black prisons, you know, think of the infringements on our liberties here in this country and elsewhere. There's a whole lot of accumulated evil that stemmed from that. Gerhard Schröder in Bonn at the time, was in Berlin yet, you know, he knew how to, well, I guess it was almost brilliant. Yeah, he knew how to face into that in any case. And so we're saying to Angela Merkel, look, we know that you're on the conservative side of the spectrum, but think about German interests and think about the interests of peace in Europe this time. And you have precedent for acting courageously. Why don't you try it? You might like it.
Yeah. Well, now, I don't know. This is stupid, Ray, but aren't you an American patriot? Why are you over there telling the Germans to stop doing what the American government wants them to do?
No, I'm just telling the truth. You know, I don't tell anybody to do anything or avoid doing anything. I, I just point out that as an intelligence professional, those fuzzy images that have been shown to implicate the Russians in doing dastardly things, they are an embarrassment to an intelligence professional, that the U.S. and Russia have far better evidence. Why they don't produce it with respect to the U.S., at least on Russian invasion, makes me think that they don't have any better than that. And so that makes me think that this is all a convenient excuse. You see, maybe your listeners are not aware of this, some of them at least, but 3 weeks ago, if you'll recall, the media was full of reports that the Ukrainian army was making great strides. It was pretty much a mop-up campaign. Those rebels, which are called pro-Russian separatists out there in southeastern Ukraine, they were on the verge of being wiped out, right? Now, let me correct the pro-Russian separatists. That ain't what they are. What they are anti-coup d'etat federalists. They don't like the U.S., NATO, EC, the EU coming in and mounting a coup d'etat against the duly elected president, in that case Yanukovych, and putting in their own little clients, Yatsenyuk and Poroshenko. They don't like that. And so they're anti-coup. And are they separatists? Do they want to join Russia? They don't want to join. Right? They just want a federal system where they have a degree of regional autonomy. I hear some music starting there.
We got to go out and take this break, Ray. Thank you for your patience. I'll put you on hold here, and we'll be right back, everybody, and talk more with Ray McGovern about America and Russia's relationship, and of course, the crisis in Ukraine, the ceasefire, the end of it, NATO expansion and rapid reaction forces, and the rest. Former CIA officer Ray McGovern from Moscow, when we get back. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Live here at LRN.FM, the Liberty Radio Network and affiliates, noon to 3 Eastern Time weekdays. Full interview and whole show archives available at scotthorton.org on iTunes and Stitcher. All right. On the line with Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst turned veteran intelligence professional for sanity. You can find virtually everything he writes at consortiumnews.com and at antiwar.com. And right now he's in Moscow, and he's there for the Russia Forum. Gave a speech and meeting with people there about trying to heal America's relationship with Russia, which is in crisis right now because of the American-backed coup d'etat in February in Kiev and the war by that government against rebels in the East who have refused to accept their rule since. And Ray, before the break, you were making the point that I think at least you were about to make the point that even when they voted for their autonomy, they didn't really vote to secede from the Union necessarily. They just, apparently want more local control than before. It was pretty kind of loose language in the vote. It was not a vote to secede. And of course, the Russians have made it clear, we don't want you. So you're not going to be the next new state in the Russian Federation. You're going to stay in Ukraine. You're not welcome in the first place. And so that's, a very important couple of points to make, contrary to the narrative here. And you can elaborate on those if you want. But I think also you were going to talk about, the reason that they came to the terms they came to was because the locals were winning against the Kiev government. That narrative fell apart too.
Yeah, it's amazing how the narratives fall apart. What you just described is a situation with respect to the, quote, pro-Russian separatists, end quote, is separatist is not quite the right word. Pro-Russian, perhaps, because many of them have Russian roots, but the Russians don't want them, and there's no indication that most of the, what I call the anti-coup federalists, that they want anything more than local autonomy, control over their budget, you know, the kind of regionalism we have in this country, in the United States. So we could dispatch with that. Now, with respect to the Russian invasion, so-called, when the narrative became severely dented by reality, the narrative being that the Ukrainian government forces were winning, it was due to the incredibly poor leadership by the Ukrainian army, by cousins that didn't want to shoot up their cousins, by people who were running out of ammunition and food and running back home to Western Ukraine and writing their moms and saying, this is terrible, these colonels and majors don't know what they're doing, and leaving their weapons behind and being encircled by the so-called rebels. Well, that's bad news. And all of a sudden, there was a different story. So how do you explain all that? The Russians are coming. The Russians have come. The Russians turned the tide. And what do they use to prove that? A bunch of fuzzy photographs. Well, you know, I'm sure there are Russians fighting there in the southeastern Ukraine, but I don't think there are columns of tanks pouring in. The Organization for Peace and Security and Cooperation in Europe, which has monitors down there, has deliberately contradicted the Kiev government's account and the U.S. government's account that the Russians have come. It was used as an excuse to explain the fact that these are poorly led, poorly trained, not really dependable Kiev forces. Now, Scott, before I forget, you know, at conferences like this, there are golden opportunities to meet really, really interesting and important people. And I include in that a professor at Moscow State University now called Viktor Kuvaldin. Okay, now who is he? He was one of Gorbachev's chief advisors between 1989 and 1991.
Wow, really?
Wow. Uh-huh. Those were the critical years. Berlin Wall fell. Gorbachev meets with George H.W. Bush in Malta for a summit first week in December. And then James Baker goes over to Moscow to talk with Gorbachev and Shevardnadze and does that deal, the quid being a reunified Germany, the quo being NATO not moving one inch to the east. So here I had this opportunity to say, this is the next best thing to asking Gorbachev himself, which of course several people have done, and he's explained that what we say is correct, that what we analysts say, namely that the U.S. reneged or welched on the deal, is absolutely correct. So I said to Kuvaldin, I said, Professor, why was that agreement not written down? And he said, Mr. McGovern, you have to go back to those times. Gorbachev just wanted to get this behind him. He was seized with immense domestic problems, and he trusted Baker. There was no thought on our part, the part of us Russians, that you would want to move NATO any closer to us. We were falling apart. We wouldn't have a military worth the name in another decade. And that's, of course, what Jack Matlock, the U.S. ambassador to Russia at the time, told me. He said, you know, the thought never occurred to me that once the Warsaw Pact sort of dissolved and just went away, that NATO not only would not go away, but would double in size and then want to add Ukraine as well. So this was really an interesting thing to have a chance to talk to this Gorbachev's one of his major advisors here. And he confirmed a lot of the things that I was thinking. And he and Matlock are both, you know, sort of distraught that it wasn't written down. But number two things, it was just an incredibly busy time for them. And number two, they trusted us. and they trusted us. It never occurred to them that with the Soviet menace gone, that the United States and NATO would do what George H.W. Bush promised not to do, and that is take advantage of that. And of course, that's what we've done. And that, of course, is the taproot, you know, the real basic reason why the Ukraine situation is so delicate. And we had a chance to talk about all that today, too. It was really, really interesting with the Soviet scholars and former officials, and then, of course, a smattering of U.S. scholars and Western scholars from other European nations. It was really a golden opportunity, Scott.
Yeah, I talked with Jack Matlock on the show last week again, actually, and he talked all about that as well. They didn't even want the Soviet Union to come apart, which, I mean, that to me blows my mind. They were trying to convince Belarus and Ukraine to stay in the USSR. But anyway, let me ask you real quick here, because we're almost out of time, and I need to ask you about the current ceasefire and, you know, the militias, perhaps on both sides, who can still ruin it. There are claims on both sides of interruptions. Is there enough central control of either side to actually mandate a ceasefire? Can we move forward from here? What's going to happen?
Well, as usual, Scott, you're asking exactly the right question. The BBC asked me that question at 6 o'clock this morning, Moscow time. I told them, look, this time you have Poroshenko and you have Putin. They're both trying to make it work. They're both bragging about what they achieved last Friday and Saturday. So that's a biggie, okay? Now, what's the problem? Well, the problem is that Poroshenko and Yatsenyuk, they both dance to the tune from Washington. And so if Washington wants to continue this struggle, wants to make this still a civil war and pursue its own aims, then there's a good chance that if not Poroshenko, Yatsenyuk, who has always been way out in front, and the support of the proto-fascists out there, the right sector and the Svoboda people, that they can make the kinds of provocations that will have the war get underway again. What weighs against that is they're going to get a really, really bloody nose, and in my view, probably the anti-coup federalists are going to take Mariupol, and that would be big, because that would be a major giant step toward having a land bridge between Russia and Crimea. So there are two things that are hard to control. One of the folks in Kiev, and then even if you get the people in Kiev under control, there's some real question as to whether they can control the rightists in that part of the Ukraine.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got to stop there. We're out of time. But thanks very much for your time. Great to talk to you again. And let me know when you get back.
Glad to be with you, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's the great Ray McGovern. He's at raymcgovern.com, at consortiumnews.com, and at antiwar.com. And right now he's in Moscow trying to forge peace. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to fff.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014 at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org. All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. Up next is our friend Adam Morrow on the line from Cairo, Egypt. Welcome back, Adam. How are you?
Good, Scott. Thank you. Glad to be back.
Very happy to have you here. Adam writes for Interpress Service. That's ipsnews.net. Although, honestly, I forgot to even check your archive and see if you have any new ones up there, Adam.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
Do you have any new ones up there?
I haven't been filing anything lately, unfortunately. But I promised you last time, I will definitely get on that.
Yeah, you got a history to report on
skeptical.
Going on there.
I know you got
a real life and a real job too, but is what it is. We got to know. And anyway, at least I get to have you on the show, and you get to tell us, about Egypt's march back to democracy since military thankfully overthrew the elected government of that country in order to restore it, according to our Secretary of State. Going pretty well?
Yeah, well, not so much, actually. If the last time we spoke, we haven't spoken in a while. I think it was probably before the whole Gaza stuff.
Yeah, I think
happened,
so, yeah.
But I think
it may even been before ISIS sacked Mosul.
I think it was probably after that, but not very much long after that. It was probably the last time we spoke.
Yeah, a couple months.
But if you remember, even then, I was saying that after a very euphoric beginning to the military takeover here that happened, what, about 14, 15 months ago in July of last year, since that time, President Sisi, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's popularity has waned really, really badly because, I mean, he was expected, like his predecessors, you know, he was sort of expected to immediately solve all these longstanding chronic problems that Egypt has had all of these decades, and he hasn't been able to do that. So his popularity has waned a lot in the last year alone. And I think in an effort to do that, they're sort of taking steps now on the domestic front. They're focusing on two things, and one of them is to sort of distract everybody's attention with talk of terrorism, both domestic and regional. And the other is to embark on maybe these glory projects. Like they just unveiled 2 or 3 weeks ago, they just unveiled a vast new Suez Canal project that will allow several more ships to dock inside the canal or something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's been sort of rolled out amid tremendous fanfare and is being touted as a huge achievement by the leader. I mean, it hasn't been built yet or anything. I think it'll be built over the course of the next couple of years. But I mean, a lot of economists and stuff like that have come out and saying that there was actually no real reason to even build this thing, and that it was, I mean, it's entirely a vanity project, and it's being interpreted largely as a desperate attempt to sort of to bolster his popularity, which, as I said, has been on the wane for the last couple of months. You still have skyrocketing inflation is out of control. You just had big subsidy cuts on fuel prices, which sent fuel prices going up by 50%, 70% in some cases, which just affected inflation further. So you have all of these traditional complaints that still have yet to be solved, you know. So we're basically, like, as we said last time, we're basically back. In terms of public, you know, resentment, we're sort of back to where we were right before the 2011 election. It's almost as if that never happened, you know, with a lot of promises from the new government that things will get better. And, you know, people, you know, the public is being urged to wait and be patient and all of this sort of thing. But we're right back where we were on, you know, January 24th, 2011 at this point.
Yeah, it's sad. And of course, the problem is my funny bone is just completely shattered at this point. And so the sarcasm, I guess, wasn't apparent to you probably or anybody in the audience either. Of course, I was just trying to mock the position of the U.S. government that it was the restoration of democracy when the military canceled the results of the presidential election and put its winner in prison. Not that I was ever pro-Muslim Brotherhood or anything, but it seemed like that was the progress of the Arab Spring in Egypt. We're going to have elections, real ones now. But no.
Maybe I've been in Egypt too long, but that's the, so here, a lot of people wouldn't take that sarcastically and would take it seriously, what you said about the return to democracy.
Well, because I guess, you know, people really do hate the Muslim Brotherhood, right? Not just the military.
Sorry, what's that?
It sounds like, do you mean to say that they're the people who really hated the Muslim Brotherhood that much, even though they had won the election, is that what you're saying?
I'm saying the media did such a job on the public here for months and even years, even since Morsi's time and before Morsi, Morsi being the president who was ousted a year ago, Mohamed Morsi. The media has been consistently attacking the Brotherhood. For example, we have these we've been suffering from these intermittent power cuts. We're getting four or five. It's better now, but at the height, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, four or five power cuts, hour-long power cuts a day, all across Cairo. And that went on for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I mean, it was really, really getting bad. And then I think 3 or 4 days ago, there was a massive, massive power outage. The entire grid was somehow affected. And there was a huge, huge, like, semi-country, well, it wasn't countrywide, but it was like large swaths of the country when power went down for several hours. So that's and that's something that Morsi was consistently being, you know, was consistently being blamed for during his time. The media was constantly attacking him and the media for being unable to provide a simple basic service like electricity. And now you have, you know, a year after his ouster, you still have the same problem, and it's even worse. It's even getting worse. In fact, Sisi came on television yesterday and sort of made an appeal to the public to be patient about these power outages, and you even have, you know, the hardcore elements of the government and the pro army camp are saying that it's like Muslim Brotherhood cells that are sabotaging the power network. So it's like every single thing, you know, this is a demonization of the Brotherhood has been going on for so long now, for months, years. And unfortunately, there are large swaths of the population that really, really buy into this stuff. Like, an educated Egyptian watches some of this stuff, and he'll laugh at how ridiculous this anti-Ikhwan propaganda is, you know? Yeah. But you can't forget that at the same time, tens of millions of very simple Egyptians who maybe aren't as educated actually buy into it. I sort of learned that recently. I didn't realize how powerful the draw that the state media has here. But really, tens of millions of people rely on the state media here and actually believe it's you know, these ridiculous lies, most of which have been aimed at the Brotherhood for the past 2 years.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so one of, I guess, what sounds, at least to my Western ears, like one of the more powerful pieces of propaganda against them is that they really tried to not just put all their guys in every appointed position they possibly could, change over to their thing. But they really tried to, you know, Talibanize the government and enforce, you know, as much of their Islamist doctrine as they possibly could in terms of clamping down on people's kind of personal and professional behavior in a way that was considered way out of bounds, where they really should have been just working on solidifying their power, making as many alliances as they could, even with the liberals, as we've talked about before, that they, you know, basically it would be like having Pat Robertson come to power with super majorities in both House of Congress and just, legislate every right-wing, born-again Taliban thing they could come up with against the rest of us in America. That's at least the way it's portrayed. But is that not true, that the Muslim Brotherhood passed a bunch of that kind of personal stuff?
That's actually a huge misconception. That's something that's the sort of thing that I see all the time repeated ad infinitum in the media about Morsi's disastrous year in power, in which he showed himself to be this authoritarian and tried to like foist Islamist rules and make everybody follow his way of thinking. And all. That's actually not the case at all. They actually were bending over backwards. Morsi in particular and the Brotherhood in general were bending over backwards to ensure everybody, or to reassure everybody that they were not going to, that they weren't going to change anything that would affect personal freedoms. There was no intention to go after alcohol, the sale of alcohol, for example. There was no intention to touch dress codes in any way. Now, a valid criticism, remember, the Brotherhood have always been gradualists.
All right, now, hold it right there. Sure. Very important point to pick up on the other side of this break. We're on the phone with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, IPSnews.net, reporting live from Cairo. The restoration of military rule in Egypt. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. And I'm talking with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, living in Cairo, Egypt. And, you know, in a way, it's my fault. I'm sure I forget at which point I screwed this up, Adam, but this whole conversation we're having is beside the point. Nothing would justify the Egyptian military overthrowing the government as they did a year and a couple of months ago there. So talking about what all true is.
It.
I'm sorry?
I mean, something would justify it, Scott. If crimes were being committed against the people and that sort of thing, if there were actual crimes being committed by this elected government, then there would be a would be a legitimate reason for the military to step in. But there weren't.
Well, even then, there ought to be civilian processes for exchanges of power. You know, like impeachment or that, you know, something along those lines without a coup. But anyway, point being you know, they can demonize the Muslim Brotherhood all they want. And you're saying that, you know, a whole lot of that, the mess of it is not even really true. You're conceding
that.
It was
just a massive exaggeration. It was a massive exaggeration, Scott, that the Western media actually sort of played a big part in. There was very, very little critical analysis of what. There was very little explanation of why Morsi was doing some of the things he was doing. For example, a decree that he issued that basically overrode the judiciary and gave him greater powers in November of 2012 was almost inevitably described as a power grab in the Western media, without any real explanation as to why he needed to override the judiciary, the Mubarak judiciary, in the first place, because the Mubarak era judiciary was stalling all of this legislation that he needed in order to get parliamentary elections going, et cetera, et cetera. So there were valid reasons. He had valid reasons for doing some of these things, and they were just entirely either, you know, they were misinterpreted or they were willingly misinterpreted, mm-hmm. and certainly spun in a very dishonest way, both especially in the domestic media here and in the international media.
Yeah, which is interesting because, you know, if you read the New York Times closely, you'll see that they would concede that the judiciary is simply a bastion of military power within the government that absolutely was an obstacle in every way. That's not really in dispute. It's just not included in the narrative. Right.
Yet Morsi is constantly criticized for the main criticism was that he tried to get all the power in his hands by issuing this decree that overrode the judiciary. And that's the main point why everybody always says his authoritarian rule, you know, that was his rule that was marked by authoritarianism. They're constantly harping on the authoritarian thing. And it's really, yes, he did that was an authoritarian move to make, but there were reasons for it. There were valid reasons for it. And unfortunately, in this era, you know, in the current era of mass media that we have now, you seldom hear the real reasons why, if they don't want you to know them, you won't hear what the real reasons why people are doing things. You know, they'll just be sort of casually written off as a power grab or something very simple that doesn't convey the actual, you know, the actual meaning behind them.
Mm. All right. And now when Field Marshal Sisi did the coup last year, is it your understanding that America was really behind that or with a wink and a nod or they actually supported it Iran 53 style or what?
Well, we've debated this in the past, and it's not sure. It's until now, it's sort of uncertain. It's sort of an open question, just how much they knew. I personally think it's impossible that they didn't know. All signs would point. And if they didn't want it to happen, I mean, I don't think it would have happened. It was done with the explicit. It was quarterbacked by America's very, very close allies in the region, mm-hmm. being Saudi and the Emirates in particular. So, I mean, the American connection is the U.S. didn't play much of a role, but I'm sure they knew it.
Well, you know, the reason
I
ask it that way is there's been a lot of.
And if you look at what they said, well, it's interesting. If you look at what happened in the wake of the coup as well, a similar thing sort of happened in the wake of the January 25th revolution in 2011. The U.S. sort of didn't know which way to go. You know, it was sort of caught between supporting an elected president and supporting what the Egyptians were calling this popular revolution, mm-hmm. you know? So the U.S. itself sort of went back and forth. But up until now, it continues to say, it continues to describe Sisi as the guy who's going to bring democracy to Egypt, right. And who, the guy who's
that
put
really,
Egypt back on the democratic path.
Yeah, that
so,
gives away
I mean,
the game
they
right
certainly
there.
Don't object. They're certainly not objecting to it. Listen, another thing I don't know if you want to talk about, very interesting, Scott, if you caught it, the attacks on Benghazi that happened maybe 2-3 weeks ago. That have been attributed to the United Arab Emirates and Egypt.
Oh, you're talking about I'm sorry, I didn't hear you well. You say the attacks on Tripoli, Libya?
Was it in Tripoli? Yeah, it was in Tripoli. It was in Tripoli. These mystery airstrikes.
Right.
Well, just, I mean, that's a very interesting development. The U.S.
You know what,
basically said...
I'm sorry, we're so short on time. I want to let's stick to Egypt for just a second here because I wanted to ask you about the reason I had asked you about America's role in the coup was just because there was, you know, had been some hype about how, oh, America's diminished influence, now even Egypt, our former loyal sock puppet, you know, dictatorship under Mubarak, is now closer to Saudi and UAE, as you said, and they don't even pay much attention to America anymore. And, you know, part of that is just, you know, right-wing hype about Obama's a feckless president and this kind of, you know, red herring stuff. But I wonder whether there was some truth to that. But then again, I would also add that it doesn't seem like there's any daylight whatsoever between Egypt and Israel right now. So if that's any indication, they're just as much in America's pocket as ever. But what do you think of that?
Yeah, it's a very weird dynamic. I mean, there's definitely distance between Israel and the U.S. as well, because in the wake of Gaza, I mean, during Gaza, the U.S. was getting like really embarrassed by Israel's actions. You know, it was getting, I mean, they were really getting, even the U.S. was getting pissed off, you could tell. You know, with John Kerry getting caught saying that, he said something on the, he sort of got caught on camera, you know, very upset about something that had happened. And then there was, the U.S. was actually using some unprecedented language. I think they described something as, something that Israel did as I can't remember the exact word, but it was an unprecedented use of language by the U.S. In criticism of critical of Israel.
That's true.
So there's definitely space has definitely opened up over there, and I definitely think there is some truth to the idea that Egypt is moving away from the U.S. orbit and moving closer to these Gulf states, which are also very closely aligned with Israel now. Mm-hmm. I think there is. It's incredibly confusing. There is something to that. There is something to the idea that Egypt is moving away from, is moving out of the U.S. orbit, though, closer to Saudi and the Emirates, and they seem to be sort of more in line with the hardcore, the hard right Israelis than they are with Obama's Washington, at least.
Yeah. All right. So tell me briefly about the domestic police state in Egypt now.
Sorry, say that again, Scott?
Tell me about the domestic police state there, the emergency laws and torture and that kind of thing.
Well, it's really bad. I mean, reports are constantly emerging of torture. There have been torture videos are popping up on YouTube all the time. You've got constant criticisms and condemnations coming out from human rights organizations and things like that. But, I mean, none of that seems to – they don't seem to care. They don't seem to care, you know, the way they spin it is like this, you know, they're in the middle of like an existential fight with terrorism.
Yeah, as Rudy Giuliani said, it all depends who's doing it.
They're trying to draw a parallel between the Brotherhood here and the Islamic State phenomenon in the Levant, you know, so they're trying to turn the whole and the Libyan Islamist militias in Libya, they're trying to draw them all as this part of this huge international Islamist onslaught that like only these like, you know, hard ass generals can stop. Mm-hmm. And even Sisi has just recently come out just within the last day or two talking about like a pan-Arab, some kind of pan-Arab alliance, military alliance in order to fight extremism.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
so it's sounding pretty grim.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying that ISIS is in Sinai now. So not just terrorists, but the Islamic State is there. And do you think there's any truth to that?
Sorry, Scott, you're breaking up pretty bad.
Do you think there's any truth to the accusations that the Islamic State is in Sinai, part of this hype?
Sorry?
There's hype that the Islamic State has members in the Sinai Peninsula now. I wonder if you think that's
just BS. Oh, yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. Personally, I'm extremely suspicious about the whole Islamic State phenomenon, and I think it's highly, highly dubious that they would have guys in Sinai. I mean, basically, you can attribute anything to Sinai, because Sinai is, like, locked down, and it's like a war zone, and we have no idea what's going on there, and because it shares borders with both Israel and the Gaza Strip, so it's, like, incredibly sensitive, and you've got the smuggling tunnels, and you've got all this stuff going on. Like, anything can be attributed to Sinai, you know? I mean, there was this phase where people were calling it Egypt's Tora Bora. I mean, just typical sensationalist, you know, nonsense. Mm-hmm. So, like, anything could be. It doesn't surprise me at all that ridiculous people would say that the Islamic State is now beheading people in Sinai. That wouldn't surprise me at all. But, I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, I don't think they went that far necessarily. What I read didn't have beheadings. But, yeah, I mean, all it takes is one goofball raising a black flag and then... you can spin it however you want. You want a whole new war?
Yeah,
you
exactly. No, a couple of decapitated bodies were found in Sinai about a week ago.
Oh, okay.
And,
no,
yeah,
I hadn't seen it.
And immediately the first thing everybody did was being like, oh, but there's still no evidence that ISIS is in Sinai, you know, but still managing to raise the specter.
Right. And, you know, Netanyahu, of course, equates Hamas with ISIS. And yet when an Al-Qaeda loyal group poked its head up in Hamas about 2 or 3 years ago, I guess now, in the Gaza Strip, Hamas went and killed them in a day, or a couple of dozen of them, or
something.
That's right. Completely.
That's right. I remember that. Listen, it's very important for your listeners to understand. Maybe I know a lot of Americans are getting extremely confused right now by the plethora of Islamist groups and all of these crazy different, you know, one is more extremist than the next, you know. Mm. But it's very important that the listeners understand that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. Which is the group of which Morsi was a member, of which the ousted president was a member, and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, which is the group that just fought off the 51-day Israeli onslaught. That both of those groups are entirely different from these other wacko groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all these other crazy groups that cut off people's heads and call for international jihad and all of this stuff. I mean, the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood, and these are groups that have participated in elections, you know, have participated in and won internationally recognized elections. They have very specific political programs, you know, they have very specific visions and mission statements. And for the most part, you know, I mean, it's different with Hamas because of the occupation thing and the resistance. But it's certainly in the case of the Muslim Brotherhood, they do not espouse violence, you know, domestic violence for any reason whatsoever.
Well, and the key
Hamas, of course.
The key, Adam, is what you said about standing for election, that they have made the decision basically permanently at the highest strategic kind of level that they are playing the Western game. Just like, you know, Iran with the IAEA and the nuclear program. Hey, look, we're going along with the deal. And that's what Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood have tried to do here. That's why Ayman al-Zawahiri has always denounced them as a bunch of sellouts and Westerners for playing the game. Because they keep trying to play the game. And so just like with the joint government there between Hamas and the PLA in the West Bank, it was basically, before the Israelis started a war over it, it was basically Hamas signing up for the PLA's approach to dealing with Israel and the United States toward, Palestinian state. That was Hamas basically ceding their goals in order to join up with the PLA. And then the punishment for that is war. You know, it's crazy.
Right. Right, right. Well, it's almost like the more moderate they become and the more reasonable they show themselves to be, the more in danger they put themselves, the more of a danger they become.
Yeah.
Like Israel will want to hit them immediately before they, you know, before they sort of reinvent themselves in a moderate, as a reasonable force or a moderate force, because then they would actually be, you know, then they wouldn't have an argument against them. They wouldn't be able to use force against them. They would have to deal with them, you know, as a political force.
Right.
So before they even have a chance to do that, they're struck,
this is a group that has used suicide attacks against civilians in the past and that kind of thing. I mean, nobody's saying they're great guys, but the point being that, well, certainly the U.S. and Israel have arranged it so where they're the only political force the people of the Gaza Strip have. They don't have anybody else to choose from, really. You know,
and let's not forget that they too came via elections in January 2006, legislative elections that they swept.
Right.
This is Hamas in Gaza. I'm talking about.
Right. That America and Israel arranged.
Right.
All right. Anyway, so listen, man, I better let you go. I kept you over time here, but thanks so much for your time, Adam. It's great to talk to you again.
Hey, thanks, Scott. I hope to talk to you again soon.
All right. See you. That's our friend Adam Morrow, everybody, reporting from Cairo there. About the situation under the dictatorship of Field Marshal, is it Fatah al-Sisi, I think? Hang on, I got a cough. I'm still here. I was just coughing. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. I guess we're already back from break. Sometimes I just blow the brakes. I try to be disciplined. But then, you know, I blow the brakes so often, then it seems like I'm not being fair to the other guests when I make them sit on hold. But no, that's the standard. That's how it should be, is the breaks. Because otherwise, it just doesn't sound right to you people listening live here. Going out to break in the middle of a sentence and this kind of thing is just stupid. coming back from break in the middle of a conversation must sound terrible. But what am I going to do? Tell everybody to shut up and stop talking? Tell myself to shut up and stop talking? Not likely. Very difficult, anyway. This is the show. And, yeah, so Egypt, there's a damn mess. There's some coverage of it for you. But now I'm glad, actually, that I could let him go because there's other stuff I got to talk to you about. Radley Balco has written this thing. I guess it's been there for a little while. September the 3rd. It's called How Municipalities in St. Louis County, Missouri Profit from Poverty. And it's not even about the drug war, man. You know what it is? It's the traffic war. You don't have current tax stamps on your windshield. You don't have insurance. Your license is suspended. You're on probation. You've got a failure to appear. You got fired because you tried to appear, but they moved your court date to somewhere else, and whatever, whatever. And without hyperbole, just good journalism, Radley Balco portrays a situation where it's simply war by the sheriff's departments of Missouri against the poor and the black. Because they don't have any political representation. They don't have any lawyers that they can afford. He does profile some heroic volunteers, the arch city defenders who do everything they can. But it's three lawyers against the entire system. And this is true all across America, and you don't have to be black to be a victim. In fact, right now, a big part of this fundraiser I'm doing is trying to get out from under expired tax stamps, no insurance, and then failure to appear means license suspended. I'm paying thousands of dollars to get out from under this. That's why I got to beg you guys for money all the damn time. A big part of it. I had to hire a lawyer out in L.A., and then the hoops I got to jump through to get all of my, you know, stuff together here in Texas on the Texas level. It's absolutely ridiculous, man. I got to get a title and this and that. Go down there again. And then it's horrible. And if you're sick or you're poor or you barely have a job, but it requires that, yeah, you show up all day, every day. No Friday off because you got to take care of some business type days for you. Then you're just done. And how, of course, the state is the greatest enemy of poor people. The state. This isn't even about the war on drugs. This is just the war on you daring to try to travel around without all your papers in order. If you're rich enough and educated enough and have your business sense together enough, you take care of as much of this stuff by mail as you can. You can always afford it. You write it down on your calendar, registration again, and it becomes not that big of a deal. Maybe you can't even see how it's that big of a deal to people. But hundreds and hundreds of dollars is a lot of money to a lot of people who are just barely getting by, if at all. And this is, if you read this thing, you will see it is a war against the politically powerless, mostly black citizens of Missouri. Like Jim Crow, only different. The people who have nothing don't have enough to defend themselves from the parasites. So, you know, taxation, not good enough. These are poor areas. And so, it's all about the fines. And, of course, just like you could imagine, if you imagined it, it's like an episode of The Outer Limits from when you were a kid or whatever. Guess what? The police are in it for themselves. The governments are in it for themselves. They're not the security force. They're not here to love you and protect you. Just think about this insane, radical, extremist thought experiment. What if the people of Ferguson just decided they wanted to secede from the state of Missouri? We don't recognize your jurisdiction here anymore. You're not our security force. You are our enemy. You are not the law. You are in defiance of every bit of our rights. And so beat it. We have the right to be free. What if they did that? What if they tried it? Right, the local cops would bring out all that military gear and kill them. And if that didn't work, they would bring in the National Guard to help. And if that didn't work, they'd bring in the army to finish the job. the poor black people of Missouri, they're not free. They have no right to change their situation whatsoever. Just suffer. And, you know, what I really, this is a really great piece. It's at the Washington Post again, the great Radley Balco. And it's, you know, a giant 10,000 word article or something so that he can tell you the stories of all these different people, man. This is what it's like to just try to live in this predatory state. It's madness, and it ought to make you mad. It's absolutely incredible. It's incredible to think that Americans can go along continuing to call this the USA and allow this to be how it is, you know? It's just absolutely out of control. The article again, how St. Louis counties in Missouri profit from poverty. Get you for just an expired inspection sticker is enough to keep you on probation at least, and without your license, and even poorer, and unable to afford to ever get insurance again, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, unable to get to work, unable to make any progress whatsoever. That's the name of their business. All of this stuff about how they're here for you is just hype. It only ever was hype. You know how you know that's true? Because that's what George Carlin said so, man. They don't care about you. Oh, they give you welfare, you know, Lone Star card here in Texas, help you buy some groceries, or, you know, help you with this and that, get you in debt for the rest of your life for education you don't need from their government schools. They're the ones breaking your leg. What we need is freedom, not good government. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, guys, so I just tweeted out this article by Shane Bauer. You might remember he was captured by Iran, held as a spy for a few years there. Before that, he was interviewee on this show. Come to think of it, he'd done some journalism about the Iran and U.S.-backed Badr Brigade death squads serving Nouri al-Maliki back in, let's say, 2007. Could have been 8. Anyway, so here he is covering the Urban Shield SWAT convention in Oakland. You might have seen over the weekend, if you were stuck to Twitter like me, Shane Bauer put out a whole bunch of tweets. Well, here they all are at Storify.com, where I guess you can compile tweets. I just tweeted out the link to it if you want to look at my Twitter, twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Or if you want to join up the chat room, you'll see the link come through there here in a second, probably. My Twitter feeds to the chat room, it seems. All right. And Bauer said, no, I won't do your show because I'm working on the story and trying not to be distracted. So I says, oh, he was more polite than that. So I says, well, put me on the list, so that when the story's done, I can interview you about the story. Right now, it's just a bunch of tweets and a lot of pictures. But what it is it's all a bunch of SWAT teams coming together at a convention in Oakland, California, to compare gear and killing techniques and stuff. And it's very interesting stuff. I'm going to just leave my police state coverage for the day at that. You can find the link on my Twitter feed there. All right, now let me talk to you about ancient history, George Bush's torture program. Now, Barack Obama has a torture program. It's not quite as severe, although I guess it depends. If you were the subject of it, you might think it was severe enough for you. But Bush's torture program, well, they tortured more than 100 people to death, although supposedly the CIA only tortured 2 people to death. Actually, the other Scott Horton has reported on the deaths of three more at Guantanamo Bay at Penny Lane down there, Camp No, as he called it, and as it was called previously. Penny Lane was the code name for it. But you can read all about that by the other Scott Horton, heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer and professor at Columbia University, in his work on the Guantanamo suicides and his follow-up articles at harpers.org. So there they were lying when they said only two, because now five. And now how many more than that? We don't know. The other 100 and something apparently were killed by the military. Tortured to death by the military as opposed to by the CIA. That's, you know, they narrow the question that way. They had an investigation into the CIA's destruction of all the torture tapes, obstruction of justice. So they were looking into that, and then they said, well, we'll look at a couple of cases of murder under the CIA here. And then they said, no, and it was just a preliminary investigation to see whether they ought to have a criminal investigation into this happening. And they decided, no, they wouldn't. And in fact, they dropped the point of the obstruction of justice for the destruction of the tapes, too. And so that was the end of that. They narrowed the point down to two different CIA murders. I believe both in Afghanistan. One was a guy who froze to death at the salt pit torture dungeon outside of Kabul. And then I'm trying to remember whether the second one was that guy Jabadi or whatever from Abu Ghraib in the pictures. Or I think that guy was killed by special forces. Or no, maybe he was killed by CIA. And that was the second one that they were, you know, admitting to actually, you know, happening and being a problem. Then, of course, they decided to not even have a criminal investigation. The preliminary investigation went nowhere. But anyway, so here in The Independent, well, look, the reason this is back in the news is because they're trying to release the Senate report. The Senate did their report. They sent it to the CIA and the White House for redactions. The CIA and the White House sent it back full of redactions. Where the, even, you know, Dianne Feinstein, she's good on anything. She's good on torture, apparently. And she got all pissed off and said, now, God dang it, you done went and redacted too much stuff. And so now they're still wrangling over what all is going to be redacted and not. But it's a 6,000-page report. What, now they're saying 3,600? I thought it was 6,300-page report. I think that the Independent I'm reading has that backwards there. It's a 6,000-page report. But all we're ever going to get is the declassified, redacted version of the summary. But here's the point. Hey, guess what? Everybody, Scott's finally getting to the point. Yeah, they're going to talk again about how many torture suspects, torture prisoners, I don't mean the torturers, I mean the victims of it, were basically killed and brought back to life. And we've talked about this on the show before. I don't know anymore if it was the IG report or the Red Cross report or which one that talked about the doctors that had the oxygen monitors on their fingers, and they would basically get them into the death spiral, like that movie Flatliners. They'd get them into the death spiral where they are not, you know, it's not simulated drowning. No, they are dying. They are almost dead. And then, oh, just kidding, pull you out of the water. Punch you in the chest, maybe give you a little bit of electroshock, smack you in the face, make sure you're not all the way dead, and then blam, back into the water again. Into the death spiral, with the doctors monitoring their oxygen levels on a little digital reader that says when they're almost dead, but not quite. That's, as they put it here, not simply being waterboarded, which simulates the sensation of drowning. The source told the Daily Telegraph they weren't just pouring water over their heads or over a cloth. They were holding them underwater until the point of death, with a doctor present to make sure they did not go too far. This was real torture. End quote. And so the thing of it is that that's a crime. This guy says they got medieval on his ass, paraphrasing Pulp Fiction, but point being, not a movie. No, real barbarism, real enlightened, Western, democratic, torturing people to death. Oh, and then saving their life and then torturing them to death again. Oh, and then saving their life again. Oh, what fun that must have been for the CIA. Oh, and their contractors. Speaking of Pulp Fiction, I got Sam Jackson to play a torturer in a movie like this where he's a contractor for the CIA, even tortures a guy's children. Because, hey, you got to do what you got to do, right? You got to make that money, right? Anyway, yeah, they got... here's the thing. It's a crime. And here's the reason they all got away with it, other than a few people working the night shift at Abu Ghraib prison. And that is because it was George W. Bush was the criminal in charge who authorized it. And he knew he was breaking the law, and he decided, I don't care. I'm going to go with David Addington and Dick Cheney's theory that there is no law that can bind the power of me, the president. And then he proceeded to break the law and torture people, including, yes, to death. And he was guilty, and the rest of them are guilty too. And the only discrepancy is whether Powell was in on it and at what point he was brought in on it, whatever. And I don't really think that's a discrepancy at all because Marcy Wheeler says so, and so I'll defer to her genius on that. But the National Security Council, all the senior officials were in on it. Condoleezza Rice was in on it. The vice president was in on it. The secretary of defense was in on it. The head of the CIA was in on it. Of course, all of their lawyers were in on it. They're all criminals. They're all guilty of torture and conspiracy to torture and in violation of the federal laws that enforce the Anti-Torture Treaty and the War Crimes Act and all the Geneva Conventions. All these are enforced by domestic federal law, supposedly, and the international agreements are. And so that's it. They all belong under the Supermax prison. That's all, because that's the law. But that's, of course, why there is no law, is because if there was a law, really... and it had to apply to people like George Bush and his helpers, then, well, they would just call the whole thing off and we would just have a dictatorship. It's just like we talked about, if there was accountability for prosecutors who knowingly prosecute innocent people, well, they would just cancel all appeals from now on. These bastards. But anyway, that's who they are, your dear leaders, your protectors. They're the kind of people who torture people to death over and over again, like in the worst kind of nightmare, and create enemies for you and your family and your community and your society. Because it's in their interest to do so, because, well, a lot of them are just simply front men for arms manufacturers, to be plain about it. If that sounds like hyperbole, which it does, go read Lockheed Stock and Two Smoking Barrels and read how all of Bush's neocons were Lockheed men. All of them. It's by Richard Cummings. It's at my website, scotthorton.org. In fact, it's great. See you tomorrow.